Hi, I'm Kate. This podcast contains some strong language, my partner answering the door, and a few glitchy tech bits, because it's real life. Welcome to Life and Inside Job, the podcast where we explore how to nourish your inner world and make it a great place to hang out, so your outer world can become more fun, meaningful, and satisfying. In this episode, I have a wonderful conversation with Scaravelli-inspired yoga teacher and trainer, Catherine Annis. I've been lucky enough to benefit from her classes over lockdown, and I found them super interesting because the focus is on our inside experience, not what the pose looks like from the outside or how far you can bend over and all that jazz. And recently, after a class, when she was encouraging us to kind of not follow her instructions, I really wanted to talk to her more. And I'm so grateful that Catherine was generous enough to lend her time. So here's our conversation. It's real and raw and honest. You made my day. You absolutely made my day in class, because I have the great pleasure and benefit of your holding space for me to move in a so-called yoga class.
I know.
In a yoga class. Because you said, teacher doesn't care what it looks like. And I jumped up and down and did a little dance.
I remember sticking your thumbs up and punching the air a little bit.
I was so happy. Because so much yoga is directed necessarily from what it looks like from the outside. And I increasingly find that's not very helpful. And it's certainly not much fun.
Yeah, I think it's fun if you're about 20 and you're super fit and you can do all the things. And you like a challenge, you know, I think then it probably is fun. But I think for a lot of us, we're not that demographic any longer. It moves away all too fast. Mm. And whilst that also may be quite fun, if your body is an easy body, and by that I mean it moves easily into the positions, I think then it can also be fun. So regardless of age, if your body is moving easily, if you haven't got any kind of niggles, then that kind of thing can be fun. And it can be really useful if your mind is ultra busy. By having something challenging to do, it stops you thinking. So I think, you know, in certain ways, it can be really helpful. But it's not fun for me anymore. You know, I feel like I've done all my jumping up and down and my big, expansive, exciting movements, you know, like scorpion and all of that. And I'm kind of interested in other things now. And over the years, I've collected injuries and bits of me don't work quite in the same way that they used to, and I've changed. I'm older and I'm different. And what we were just talking about, the whole I don't care what you're doing, what it looks like, is an interesting thing, because it is annoying if you're deeply in something as an experienced practitioner and you're going off on a direction that is calling to you and your teacher calls you back. It can be quite annoying. And I've been thinking I would like students to go off a little bit more, and to feel that it's okay to go off a little bit more, especially because we're on Zoom. You know, because you're not going to disturb anyone. You know, you can make big vocal sounds. I think we discussed this, didn't we? Maybe it was you, maybe it was somebody else. But we discussed the fact that sometimes people like to express, like they make big, heavy sighs, that kind of thing, which if you're on the mat next to somebody and they're doing that, that can be enormously distracting. But when we're on Zoom, who gives a damn?
Mm.
You can make any kind of noise because we're all muted except for the teacher. Mm. So you can get up and down and run out to the loo. You can stroke your cat. You can go to yourself, oh my God, this is boring. Or switch your camera on or off. You know, you have much more freedom as a student. Mm. So I felt in that class that it was useful and in fact required for me to say that, to acknowledge it and to say, you know, this is okay. This is ultimate self-practice, isn't it?
Mm. And it was phenomenally liberating as well.
Mm.
And something sort of, it's a slightly different angle, but something that is also interesting for me at the moment is that, sort of on the theme of inside outside, is that a teacher's voice is, so that's an external voice, is particularly penetrating.
Mm.
So hearing, Kate, I think if you touch your pelvis, I mean, pelvis tucking is a, let's not go down that road, but I think if your leg was straighter, you might, or I can see that, you know, whatever. It goes in deep, you know, I might be conscious of that or not. Teachers' voices and therapists' voices hold enormous power to penetrate our internal experience. And my background is with body psychotherapy and body work and all that kind of thing. And I observe that bodies left alone to move and invited and with presence will heal. It's a process of acceptance. Mm. It's a process of arriving. So when I hear, in this case, it was your external voice saying, I don't care. That's why I was so delighted. And I thought, yes, I have to have this conversation. Because as therapists and teachers, we don't know. We don't know the power that we have to penetrate other people's experience, and that knocks people off course, knocks the stream of their awareness off course.
Yeah, it's something that over the years I've become more and more aware of. I mean, I think I knew right from the beginning that the quality of voice was really important, because I realized that the teacher that I had at one stage in my yoga journey, his voice was really beautiful. It was a thing that I would invoke in my own head when I was practicing. And he used to deliberately do things with his voice, like say, unrelax, which could have been really annoying, but I loved it. He was an Italian guy. And I it was a very bad impression, but it was very soothing as we dropped down into Shavasana to have this voice sort of deliberately slowing right down and easing us into it. And so I realized that the quality of voice was really important, but it took me quite a long time to realize that the words that you say with that voice are also supremely important. Mm. And I think, the more that we're Zooming, the more that I'm realizing this is a thing, because, you know, I don't know what you are using right now to Zoom in to me. I have a huge, great TV screen here so I can see my students. But I'm aware that my mum, for instance, when she comes in, she's looking at me on an iPad.
Mm.
So it's a small screen. So she probably can't see much detail because she needs glasses to see close up. She's not close up. She's way back on her mat. So her main connection with me is my voice.
Mm.
And not only the quality of the voice, which is firstly important, but also what do I actually say?
Mm.
And, you know, I come from a ballet background. So ballet teachers are notoriously I was going to use the word aggressive. I don't think they would see themselves as aggressive, but they do have that reputation. They can be quite forceful because ballet is a performance art, and because you cannot go onto a ballet stage halfway good. You've got to be perfect. Otherwise it looks like shit. And it's all about the performance. So they are necessarily strict. And I think it's getting better. But certainly when I trained, the reason I'm mentioning all of this is because my teachers were perfectly nice teachers. I would not say they were abusive in any way, but they were very firm. You know, Catherine, get your leg up. You know, why don't you turn out more? We'll do it. You know, it was all quite strongly, it's not good enough. And you come out of that thinking that your body is not good enough, failing. You're not up to snuff. You know, but I was young and this is just how it was, you know, because that was my dream, to put on a tutu and be the white swan.
I hear those voices. And I, you know, I have a massive updrift of grief. You know, it brings tears to my eyes. It's just this idea that a body, a young body who can do that ballet stuff would be judged.
Well,
I don't know. I think possibly I feel upset because I've internalized a lot of those voices about being my body not functioning and not being good enough.
Well, you know, I was at school with people whose bodies were not so balletic in their look, shall we say that?
Yeah, there's a particular body type, isn't there?
A particular body type, and I do have that body type. I've got long limbs and I'm skinny. I'm not skinny now, but I was, as a teenager, I was definitely thin. And that is the kind of aesthetic that is required in a classical ballet setting, not in a dance setting, because some of the dancers that I've seen, like Mark Morris, I saw an awful critique of Mark Morris talking about his adipose tissue. And I'd been to see the same performance and they were really going on about the fact that he was too heavy.
And I
was at the same performance and he was beautiful, absolutely beautiful to watch. And I had not seen the heaviness. And it's, you know, this was.
So for our listeners who may not be for our listeners who may not be body people, adipose tissue, it means fat. Just to be really clear, this is a world-class really dancer clear, being criticised because he's fat.
Yeah, essentially. What I remember about him was that he was wearing a pink silk pyjama set and doing a beautiful solo, and it was just gorgeous. It was fluid, it was expressive, it moved me. And yet this one critic, and I can't even remember who it was, pulled out the fact that he was fat. And that's kind of the dance, you know, world. And I was, anyway, to get back to it, I was at school with a couple of girls. Well, one of my best friends at school was larger and she spent her whole life on a diet. And I knew her beyond school, beyond college, for quite a long time. And she was always concerned about her body weight because I think she'd had it drummed into her that she wasn't the perfect dancer shape. Which, you know, it just eats into you, doesn't it?
Yeah. It's internalized. Kind of, it becomes internalized self-hatred. Yeah.
And I know that it's taken me a long time to work into my body and try to like it. And I'm still using that word, try to like it. which is really interesting, even all these years later. And I do think I've got a pretty damn fine body, does most of the things I ask of it. You know, it's just, so the words that we use to communicate with our students are really important. And this is, we talk a lot about it on my teacher training course, because we ask people to think about what they're asking their students to do. You know, it's fine to be directive, put your right foot forward, put your left foot back, or one foot forward, one foot back. But then when you're asking them to come into a forward bend, you know that that's going to be an extreme position. So, you know, maybe invite them to see how it feels. So you change your directions so that they become more exploratory as you move further in, you know, into more extreme positions. And I think we have to accept that yoga is extreme. You know, people don't normally go around touching their toes.
Do they not?
It's not the normal. No, not normally. It's not the normal.
That thing at the back of the, is that saucepan lid underneath the drawer, you know, when they get stuck?
Yeah.
Well, that's a twist, exactly. Isn't it? I should have my arm delicately. Anyway.
Reaching over your head.
I know. I mean,
you know, and there's this whole kind of obsession with hip openers.
Oh, don't get me started. Don't. Oh, cover my microphone. Don't get me bloody started on that. So much sexual trauma is busted. Oh my God.
Oh, I hadn't even thought about that.
Oh,
I just thought about the pure mechanics of it.
I knew we would have an interesting conversation. This is wasn't on the script, but no, because moving any kind of sexual invasion from medics, from unwanted sexual partners, from rape. And from also very often from comments, abusive comments or invasive comments. Again, you know, this, I think this, we have a theme of penetration here in this conversation. Gets stuck in the pelvis, and it gets stuck in the fascia. It gets stuck in the womb. You know, it goes deep into the womb, depending on what you're talking about, and into the pelvic floor. So this
for men too, yeah.
For men too. Yeah, absolutely.
Obviously not their womb, but their pelvic floor and pelvic organs.
For people of all genders. And, you know, thinking about the trans community, there's all sorts of other wounds and complication and trauma there. And by, you know, if you go to your regular class and you're encouraged to open your hips as much as you can, which is very common, then what you're doing is you're pushing through all that trauma, and because you're stretching out the tissue perhaps too far, you're waking this stuff up, which comes into your consciousness. And because it's not understood or expected, you know, it comes up as agitation or anxiety or depression or reenacting behavior that will lead to the same kind of stuff. And this stuff is, I think it exists in yoga therapy. It's spoken about, it's understood, but not in the mainstream. And
no, really interesting.
I get very angry and upset about it, because it's dangerous. It's really dangerous. And there's no place, because so much of it is unconscious, there's no place for people to go to say, this happened and what do I do with it? You know, because it's not held and it's not named.
It's really interesting, isn't it? Because I hadn't even thought down that pathway, but of course that's really important. My whole thing about hip openings is that a lot of the yoga community, people who come to yoga, tend to be on the hypermobile spectrum. Not all, obviously, but many of us tend to be, because we're attracted to things that we're good at, that we find easy. And that being said, more hypermobility is not good for an already on the hypermobile spectrum body. So more hip opening is not going to soothe your aggravated sciatic nerve. More hip opening is not going to calm down your agitated groin. It might feel like a good stretch is what you need, because you've been kind of conditioned into feeling that more openness is better, more flexibility is better. But that's I think it's erroneous. I think it's muddled thinking. Mm. Mobility, yeah, the ability to move as much and as freely as you need to have a full and rich and varied life, really important. Because as soon as you start to just sit all day, then your life closes in. Mm. So mobility, absolutely. Keep moving, keep exercising, keep walking around, climbing hills, whatever it is you do. But being able to do the splits, you know, my colleague Peter Blackaby says, if you saw a horse doing the splits, you'd think there was something badly wrong. And you think about it, and you really would. And the other thing is that we tend to focus our attention on the pelvis and on the hamstrings. But if I was to stretch my little finger back that way, there would come a point where I would go, actually, that's enough. And that's my stretch receptors telling me, don't go any further, you'll hurt yourself. Mm. So the stretch response is not something to be pushed through. Mm. And I find myself with the various things that I have going on, that it helps me more to contain myself, to keep myself within the end range of my range of movement. Mm. So, you know, I could go into side splits if I went into a nice stretch. I'm using that ironically. If I could see you, you'd have seen I was putting it in inverted commas.
Well, they're called air thingamies, air inverted commas, yes.
Air quotes.
Mm. Yeah, air quotes.
So, I can feel a nice stretch, but I would much rather not feel that stretch and to feel strength and gathering. So I would move my legs closer together and draw them into me. So I'm cradling into my pelvis, and that feels more nurturing to me.
Mm. Now, you see, this is so interesting, because my experience has been that people with hypermobility tend to be people with, how can I say this politely, more open boundaries, who have to work in their personal lives to rein in the edges, so they know, because chicken and egg, who knows how it works, but because of that capacity to move through, they don't know where their edges are. So it makes perfect sense that you would feel better feeling contained and feeling your stability and grounding, because then you know where you are, right? And you know, sure, you could have your leg around your ear, but where the fuck's your toe gone?
No, it's really interesting. And that feeling of, yeah, I mean, my physiotherapist says, yes, it's because you have so many choices as a hypermobile person that you don't kind of know when to stop. And I know as a child, there was one of my matrons. We have matrons back in the day. I was at boarding school. She said to me, you don't know where to stop, do you? Because I had said something that was a bit, you know, out there. And I think I probably didn't know when to stop. Mm. You know, I didn't know when to stop pushing the boundaries. Mm. And that's growth, isn't it? That's, as a child, you grow up and you test your boundaries all the time. You're continually testing them. And if you can't feel them, you go further.
Yeah, to find out where they are. Because, the point of the testing is to find out where the edge is. So where do I stop and where... Oh, inside, outside. We're back on topic. Where do I stop and where does the world begin? And where do I feel safe within that kind of zone, say?
And it's a society thing too, because in certain societies, some things are really accepted and others aren't. It's like I went to Thailand on a massage course, and we lived up with the Hill tribe up in the northern part of Thailand. And I was really shocked to see all the women walking around with their breasts out, because this was the first time I'd been exposed to this very different culture. And yet they would not reveal their knees. Mm. So we were all walking around blithely, unwarily, with shorts on. And the guys were just overexcited beyond belief because they saw all these naked female knees.
Wow. Wow.
I know. It was really interesting because all the women wore these wrap skirts that would drop down to mid-calf and below. But they'd be naked from the waist up, you know, unless it was cold, in which case, you know, everybody covered up. But the knees were the thing. And it's just so interesting what different cultures.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe I just sound totally naive saying that. But
well, I think that the way that cultural taboos differ is endlessly fascinating. It's endlessly fascinating. And I think this is particularly pertinent at the moment in the yoga world, because yoga, the straight, there are so many different flavors, but the mainstream yoga is is designed for young white men. It's not designed for people with boobs. It's not designed for black people with big asses. It's not designed, you know, it's a white young fit bodies practice, and it's very obvious. And I'm a cis white woman. And it's very obvious to most of the classes, by and large, it's middle class, middle-aged in my case, white women that go to the classes.
I know.
And how, you know, which leaves an enormous population of people who are in need of this kind of beautiful nurture and nervous system regulation. You know, the black community and people of color who can really use these skills. And
yeah,
how can we have a more diverse student population? I suppose that's what I'm asking.
Oh God. Do you know, I would so love to say I've got the answer.
I don't expect an answer because, you know.
No. Because I'm acutely aware that I am that white, middle-class, middle-aged, dance background female that typifies the thing that, you know, I would like to move the yoga class demographic away from. Mm. It's not that I don't want people like me to be coming to class, because obviously I do, but I would love to have more men.
Mm.
I have messaged men in Facebook yoga groups to say, what would you be looking for? And I get really crass answers like, wear a G-string to class, or
really
show your booty, that kind of thing.
Really?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, and make you do a good strong class. But what I've found when men come to my classes is that they are actually quite grateful that there isn't the pushing atmosphere. Because I suppose a lot of the men that come to my classes tend to be, actually that's not true, I was about to make a sweeping statement and I've realized it's not right. I don't know, there's something about the work that we're doing that is suitable for men who are either young and fit or who are older and looking for more flexibility. Mm-hmm. It meets them. Mm-hmm. Because it's not ultra competitive or demanding.
Mm.
And I think maybe that's a relief.
Because
I think, I mean, I don't know, I'm not a man, but my sense is that men do feel quite cornered at some level. You know, there's still stereotypes, you know, about what men should be, that they should be strong, that they should be, you know, upholding the male sort of archetype. In the same way that there are female archetypes that are unhelpful as well.
Well, there's a lot of competitive, must be strong, must be more flexible. Female archetypes too. I mean, it's in a sense, it works.
It's the same thing, isn't it?
It works across the board, doesn't it?
Yeah, it really is. Mm. And I hope that when people come to my class, that it feels like a level playing field, that there's no, you know, there's no perfect way of doing it. Of course, I'm asking us to do things in a particular way. And what I have to go on is what I see on the screen or in class, you know, depending on where we are. I don't know. It's a toughie, isn't it?
Yeah, it is hard.
It's really tough.
And I think it's a work in, you know, I don't think there is an answer. I think it's a work in progress. And I think that just by asking the questions and looking at how we can invite more people in and make yoga spaces and therapy spaces and workshops more friendly is a start.
Yeah, definitely. And making classes as accessible as possible. I mean, that I think Zoom has been revelatory in that fact, because I do have quite a few people who come to my classes on Zoom who do not want to be seen. So they wouldn't come into a class because they would feel as if they were competing or compared.
Or looked at.
I don't think that. Looked at, and just the fact of being looked at is already too much for some people.
Well, that's also, you know, in our Zoom world, just to say we're recording this before Christmas, so we're just out of a second lockdown in the UK, 2020. I'm finding that more and more people are choosing not to have their camera on. And I think that, again, it is another way of regulating our nervous system, because the gaze is penetrating. And on Zoom, you don't know who's looking, I guess, in a class.
Yeah, and we're looking into people's living rooms, living spaces.
It's so intimate.
It is very intimate. Yes, so there are a few people that come to class who deliberately switch their cameras off. And some of them, I know it's because they just want to be private. And other people, it's because they don't want... I have one friend who comes and she says, I just don't want you to comment on anything that I'm doing. And so she switches her camera off, and then I can't, because I can't see it. So, you know, I think that makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
And I know when I go to classes with my teacher, I do sometimes feel the need for privacy, and I just think, I don't want people looking at me. I'm going to turn my camera off.
I can especially understand that as a yoga teacher in somebody else's class, because then you have that kind of kind of gaze.
There is a competitive gaze.
Thank you for naming that.
It may be my imagination, and it may be because that's what I do. I look at other people and I think, you know, oh, they've got a nice living room. And
imagine if somebody knocked on your window and said, oh, can you tell me where you got that clock? But actually, you don't have to, because you can Google it. Anyway, let's...
Well,
somebody told me about this. You're disappearing down a rabbit hole of paranoia. Anyway, that's not...
Anyway. But no, there is that need and that desire for a layer of privacy that, you know, thankfully with this, we can achieve.
Yeah. You get the choice.
I mean, yeah, as a teacher, that's very difficult, because if everybody turned up and they didn't want me to see them, I would be looking at me. And I would have no idea of the pace of how people were moving. So, you know, I'm glad that there are people that are happy for me to observe their practice in the same way that I would observe their practice in the classroom. And as you said to me the other day, cheering you on to do whatever it is you're doing differently or the same. But, you know, what is wonderful about Zoom is that we are not going to disturb each other. In our difference, which in a yoga class, when we're all in the same room, you might do, you know, it might be quite disturbing.
I think it's inevitable. I think that you find, you know, that's I think that's part of our wiring as humans to notice difference.
Yeah,
and then what meaning we make out of the difference is, you know, down to our conditioning and what have you.
Yeah, and our mood on that day.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you can be very sensitive on days and think, oh, and then other days, it's like fine.
Bounce off.
Yeah, yeah. Or just you see it from a different perspective.
I wanted to ask you, I'm really fascinated, Catherine, that how about your trajectory from dance, which is, as you've talked about, it is about display and external being viewed from the outside, into this way of offering yoga as you do now, which is all about the internal student's experience. So that's quite a shift.
And yet it's not at all. Yeah, only because I was introduced to yoga. I started dancing when I was 6, and I was introduced to yoga by my mom when I was about 15, so about 40 years ago. And the thing that I remember was the teacher at the time saying, imagine that your mind is like a blank page. And she was talking about shunyata, where you empty the mind completely and you just are. And I remember that session all this time later.
Wow.
I still remember her words. I mean, talk about the importance of words and ideas that penetrate. It penetrated. And that's what drew me back to yoga over and over again. I had a break from yoga, and then my grandmother died, and I thought, I need to go to a yoga class. I don't know why, it just sprang. And I started going to yoga seriously and regularly from that point.
Of course, I'm really fascinated. I have to ask you more. So what was it about the blank page that hooked you?
I don't know. I think the physical movements, because when I started, I was, you know, pretty flexible, and the yoga movements were a cinch. But it was this idea that you could stop the thoughts in the mind. And she said, you know, if your blank page starts to get crowded, turn the page and have a clean, fresh, blank page. And I was like this. Turning the page, turning the page, turning the page, turning the page.
The page turner.
Yeah, exactly. Bring on the new page, bring on the new page, bring on the new page. And gradually I managed to slow down the thoughts until I could sort of type them slower and then ask them to dissolve. And it was quite absorbing. And then my mum taught me, I was taught it as Anuloma Viloma, but I think it's called Nadi Shodhana, which is the alternate nostril breathing. She taught me that as a how to get to sleep method. So, you know, little things, subtle things went in and hooked me. And, you know, I really couldn't say why exactly, but I was absorbed with it.
Mm.
I found it really helpful. And as I've gone through my, because they ran parallel for many years, you know, yoga and dance. And they were different things. I did the dance for performance, for being noticed, for money, my income. And then I did the yoga for myself and my inner world, sanity.
So it was always an inside job.
Yeah.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. But I was interested in being able to do the things.
Mm.
So, for instance, one day I was on the mat next to a girl who was in Tripsikore, which I don't know if you know. It was a yoga performance group.
Okay.
And they were all dancers who'd come to yoga and they now perform. I'm not even sure if they're still around, but they were a big thing for a while. And they turned yoga into this amazing performance art. It was quite spectacular. And they were very, very accomplished at the movements. And she was on the mat next to me and she lifted herself up into a headstand by raising her legs up.
Whoa.
Great. Yeah. And I thought, oh, I wonder if I can do this. And I could, to my astonishment and delight. And, you know, this was my me in my young body.
Mm.
And I thought, yes, I like the feeling of being physically challenged while I'm doing something that's completely unnecessary and difficult. I just liked it. And I still like doing hard work. I mean, we've just moved to Exmoor and our house is on a slope like this.
That's a steep slope, listeners.
It's a steep slope. And to give you an idea, if you get to a certain point in the garden, you literally have to crawl up the slope.
It's a steep slope.
Very steep, very steep. And of course, you know, there is pruning and stuff that needs to happen in the garden in order for us to walk around. It's slightly overgrown. It's very beautiful, but it's slightly overgrown and it needs attention. And I have taken enormous delight in being able to push the wheelbarrow up the slope. It's very satisfying. It's got nothing to do with yoga, but you know, it's great. And I'm actually building guns.
Well, what's it for? It makes you know, it begs the question, then what is yoga for? Surely it's much more useful to do yoga so you can do something useful like push a bloody wheelbarrow or carry a shopping rather than, I don't know, being able to sit still for 2 hours or...
But being able to sit still for 2 hours means that I am happy in my skin.
Okay.
And it means I'm not going to get agitated and fly off the wall at my husband.
There are advantages to that.
There are definite advantages to that. It means that I am going to be happier in my skin, basically. And that's why I do it. That's why I talk a lot about how yoga soothes the nervous system, because that's what's fundamentally been the most helpful to me. You know, not being able to do scorpion or, well, I mean, pushing the wheelbarrow is pretty bloody helpful, but I managed to do that by practicing pushing the wheelbarrow, not by doing yoga. No figure.
So, okay, you know. I have a top tip. I need to ask you for your top tip for people to nourish their inner world. If you could offer one thing, what would that be?
I knew you were going to ask me this, and yeah, I've been thinking about it. And
it's a clincher, isn't it?
It's really tough. I mean, what I have found since moving out here is that the natural world is necessary. And having spent 30 odd years in London, where there is natural world, but you have to look for it, I think it's worth looking for it. Certainly in the last couple of years that I was in London, I used to regularly go out to Wormwood Scrubs and walk and look at the sky.
And not look in the bushes. I know that dog. Just look at the sky, not the bushes.
Didn't look in the bushes. But, you know, to see the birds and to see the natural growing patterns and to get outside as much as possible, because if we're inside in rooms too much and on screens, sorry, Zoom world, but on screens too much, it's a different world, and it's there's something about now having to look after the garden, having to look after something else that is on its own time scale, nothing to do with me. I imagine you get this from children too. You are responsible, and pets, you know, I have cats. I have to feed them first thing in the morning. So I have to look at something, look after something else that's more important than me to stop me getting too self-absorbed. I don't know. I hope that helps. She said with
her I think it's a good one. Look at a tree.
Yeah, look at a tree, touch a tree, hug a tree, go and walk down the beach.
I think trees have everything, can teach me everything I need to know about life, really, to be honest. From releasing to rooting to opening to resilience and no backbends.
Shedding.
Yeah, the releasing.
Yeah.
This autumn, I've really been interested in how the leaf has its own timing. And the leaf releases when it, without thought, without making a story about it. And I'm like, oh, God, yeah.
And I also found out this year that apparently this year we're on a, talking about trees, we're on a mast year, which means that all the acorns, all the oak trees are releasing a massive amount of acorns, all of them, not just here in this little patch of the country, but all over the country. Which just blew my mind.
And they all do it at the same time, right? They have it on the tree communication system.
Yeah.
Right, okay, this year, guys.
Yeah, go for it.
Yeah, it's extraordinary.
And it's not on a, you know, five-yearly basis. It can be 4 years or it can be 6 years. It's just they all suddenly do it. They must have an internet connection.
Well, they do. They're connected underground with the... I can't spell it. The mitochondria in the soil.
It's called you can buy, they're like little fungus threads, aren't they?
Yeah.
Microrhizal or something.
Yeah, mycorrhizal.
Yeah, that thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, maybe it's that. But amazing. Amazing. Mm. We're all connected.
Yeah. That feels like a good place to a beautiful place to close. Thank you so much, Catherine. I've really, what a juicy one, eh? I knew it was going to be good. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Kate. It's lovely to chat to you.
You can find out more about Catherine's yoga teacher training course, which starts in September 2021, at her website, which is theintelligentyogateachertraining.co.uk, or her personal site for her classes is catherineannisyoga.co.uk. I'd love to hear your responses to the issues we discussed in the conversation, and you can message me on Instagram at kate_codrington. I also want to hear what your tippy top tips are that make your inside life bloody fantastic. If you've enjoyed Life and Inside Job, please subscribe and share it with your friends. There'll be more juicy chats and tippy top tips for a fabulous inside life coming very soon.